Thank you all very much. Let me turn all this stuff on. I'm basically a print journalist who is still trying to recover. But before I get to that, I just want to tell you all, in case you have any doubts, I'm from Washington, and I've come to help you. We at NPR are sited in Washington, D.C., because when we went there, when NPR was formed in 1970, it was, in its first decade, a complete incubator baby of the federal government, lived entirely on federal grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And since the early 1980s, it has been increasingly standing on its own with the help of people who not only listen to public radio but support it, and that's individuals and corporations and foundations. And today, people still think, and you'll hear this on some kinds of shout radio, that NPR is just a federal creature that doesn't have a life of its own. In fact, in 2007, our revenue stream will be about $170 million, of which about 1% is federal grants. The rest of it comes entirely from people, individuals, foundations, and corporations, and from our member stations. I want to introduce to you all the general manager of WPLN, who's here, so we can put a face on your local radio station, Rob Gordon, right there, who's our general manager. And Rob is also on the NPR board of directors. Our board, our corporate board, is the majority of it are elected by station managers across the country. There are about nearly 300 NPR dues-paying, voting members of the NPR community. In a very peculiar way, it's a kind of 60s collaborative. It's a completely open system. The stations are autonomous, independent, and separate completely in every way, in their editorial choices and what they put on the air, in their budgeting, in their sources of income, and in their responsibility to the community. They're independent, autonomous, and make up their own minds about everything. They do not have to take NPR programming. We're not a network in the traditional sense of the word. We much more resemble, in a very interesting way, a kind of federated system. We have the board of directors reports itself to its own membership, which is 300 stations, as I said, and each station, in effect, has one vote to change our bylaws to elect the majority of the board members. So we're kind of a unicameral legislature, and we are responsible to that constituency. The stations themselves, as you know, most of the licenses are held by colleges and universities, many of them land-grant colleges, but some private universities, school boards, boards of education around the country. And so there's a deep affinity between public radio and how it is today in the United States and the great history of public education and education in general. It's an amalgamation of humanitarian values that I think reflects very deeply not only our aspirations as a society, but also the needs we have as a self-governing democracy. And this gets us to the point of this talk today, which is to talk about democracy and journalism, or as Mike and I said earlier today, it could be the other way around, it could be journalism and democracy. The point here is to say very clearly, what stands before us as a people, as a self-governing society, is the need to have fact-based information about who we are and about the world around us, in order to help us become self-actuating citizens in a society which demands responsible engagement from its citizens if the society is to be healthy and strong and, in fact, self-governing in a viable way, and not governed from the top or from the side or from the outside, but governed by the inspirations it draws from within itself, its own values, its own perspectives, its own diversities, its own perspectives, its own authentic voices. In this country, there has been a vast monopolization of both the airwaves and of print journalism, the means by which we, the people, find out information about ourselves, about our communities, about the world beyond our own communities, our regions, our states, our nation, and beyond our nation, that world which waits beyond us. And the consolidation of ownership on the commercial side of radio and television and print journalism has narrowed, in many ways, the choices we have, the independent, authentic choices and authentic voices from every community. It's quite interesting, in the past, and this has happened very quickly, in about 20 years, what had been a whole series of independently owned newspapers, family-based or small corporations, have increasingly been consolidated into big chains. It happened here in Nashville. In radio and television on the commercial side, there are, as we know, there are chains of ownership that can encompass more than 1,000 radio stations, can encompass scores of individual stations. And the role of independent, authentic voices is increasingly more and more distant across communities of America. In our branch of this enterprise, of this presentation of fact-based journalism and the role of journalism in democracy, is stayed egregiously local, centered on the community, and completely engaged in service to the community and the community's perspective. Because these stations are not part of a network, they're not part of a chain, they're not part of a corporation. They are, many of them, the licenses that exist today were asked for or sought for by from the Federal Communications Commission in the early 1970s by citizens who already knew what was happening and were in places where there was no public radio, where radio was not a means for a presentation and an exploration of the values of community, but was really started to be increasingly a presentation of commercial values, which are perfectly fine in a society, but they're not the only thing that we need to have before us. We look at our relationship with listeners as a values relationship, not as a transactional relationship. We are not first and foremost a medium for the presentation of commercial transaction possibilities. We are first and foremost a presenter and a place setter, we believe, for civil dialogue, for exploration, for trying to take in and encompass the complexities, not the complications, there are plenty of complications, but the true complications of an increasingly diverse, multi-ethnic, multicultural democracy, which depends on finding common ground to make common purpose and then find common goals to which we can move, whether it's at the community level or the level of school board or a school district or any or virtually any other activity that engages in more than the engagement of more than just family or single individuals. In that transaction, in that system of values, above all, we need to have fact-based information. Without that, we're disarmed in the world. I spent years in the Soviet Union and later years traveling across Central Europe and then the former Soviet Union, dealing with the issues that arise when people are denied open access to uncensored, unstate-controlled, unparty-controlled, unsecret police interdicted information. And all across that region of Eastern Europe, all the way out to the Pacific, across the old territory of the old Soviet Empire, people newly emancipated from control from Moscow or influence from Moscow or fear from the uniparty diktats of a uniform state control, an apparatus in which the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive were all part of the same single seamless creation, where the individual stood nearly powerless against the combined array of the powers of the state. In all these places, people were desperate to create their own newspapers independent from the state, their own radio stations and other means of the reporting, discovering a fact, testing it skeptically, and bringing it before other people. The essentials of democratic vitality and vigor. Before he wrote the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, casting his mind, like all the members of that extraordinary generation of the founders who'd come out of the Enlightenment we're seeking to say on paper what it was they meant the thing they were attempting to create to be. And with all the difficulties they had and all the confusions, Jefferson, aside from making sure that the Declaration of Independence didn't say inalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of property, which is the way it was originally construed, but life, liberty, and something ineffable, pursuit of happiness, that was an inalienable right of all of us. Before he got to that place, Jefferson cast his mind out as to what the principles might be and what was necessary for the society that they were seeking to create, a republic based on democratic principles. We know how limited they were. We know that now. But then it was a very big idea, an idea that had many, many openings and very few barricades, which they recognized. We know what they are today. But then it was a new place, completely fresh, exciting, revolutionary, truly. And what he wrote, and I'll not put it in the 18th century King James English, which he would have used, I'm going to put it in 21st century soundbite. He made the observation that a people cannot be both ignorant and free. That applies as powerfully today as it did in his mind more than 200 years ago. We cannot be ignorant of fact. We cannot be ignorant of issues. We cannot be ignorant of things that happen past the borders of our immediate reach if we're to be engaged in a truly vital, self-actuating civil society. Key to that, from my perspective, is diversity and the wide dispersion of places of authenticity. And that's not to say that the great chain newspaper chain corporations and the great networks are not places of great authenticity, where people work very hard every day to do the best they can, to report as carefully and as skeptically as they can, to test ideas, to do the very things that are done across this campus of more than 300 acres, that says we are going to test ideas against each other, we're going to put them in front of us because we know somehow going forward life isn't a single answer. It isn't going to be just one idea. It's going to be in our own lives the testing of many ideas to figure out where we need to go forth and in what fashion. And that, in fact, in doing that, we're going to need the help of others. While we may be individuals, we live in a society where interactions are part of how we live. And that's true no matter where we are. But authenticity of purpose and place, it seems to me, is essential to who we are as journalists. A chain, no matter how many identities it has across this country, it has, in the end, only one set of accountants and one set of bottom line artists. And that has happened across this country. We see now in the turmoil early in this century of the great newspaper chains, Knight Ritter disappeared, one of the best, the highest quality, most respectful of the independence of its independent members of any of the newspaper chains, gone. The Chicago Tribune, or the Tribune Company as it is now known, is now in great turmoil because of issues of doing such things as cutting back on the news staff of the Los Angeles Times, which accounts for not only a great deal of the income of the entire Tribune Company's press operations, its newspaper operations, but has to do with, in effect, if you look for profits by cutting down the very thing you are, the thing it does, the news from a newspaper, what are you left with? So these issues are not just abstractions. When we turn on television, whatever the channel is, and see a local presentation of our community as a place of auto accidents, domestic abuse, crime, murder, violence, fire, and flood, with the actual reality of the civil society seeking to find its way in the complexities of the 21st century, how to pay for clean water, how to pay for a health system that encompasses not just some citizens, but all citizens in that place, how to take care of the general hospital, which has been starved for resources, or maybe badly managed because of neglect at another level. And school systems that don't turn out people who can actually read, pushes them out the door because they're of that age and they've got to get rid of them because they don't, and they've never figured out a better way to do it. These are issues which are general. They apply across the American reality and American society today. And I'm saying the way it is done to us by our mass media is not what you ought to be demanding or what we demand. Our goal at NPR and my goal as a journalist was to place in front of people as close an approximation of what I could understand of events that passed before me, test them if I wasn't sure, find others who could attest to those, and then let the reader make up his or her own mind. That's the job of journalism. Somebody said to me once, recently we were, when I was earlier at the Post, and there were a series of terror bombings in Western Europe, and we reported that such and such group claimed responsibility. This person said to me, claimed responsibility is not what you should be reporting. You should be reporting took responsibility for doing this, not claimed, putting no qualifiers in it, not said that they did it, but say they took the blame for it. And I said to this person, if we do our activity correctly, we will tell you exactly what this group said. If they said they claimed responsibility or asserted they had done it, that's what we're going to report to you. If you want to make the judgment they should be blamed, that's your responsibility. And it has to do with what your values are and what your sense of where you stand in this issue or that issue is. It's not for us in the news columns to do that. And that reality is part of who we are, the distinction between what journalism should be and what a citizen's, where does a citizen's responsibility then start. If we do our job right, we can get there to that place. At NPR, one of the things that we've done, and one of the things that's true about public radio, is there's a great devotion between listeners and our stations, and we in Washington, to foreign reporting. We now have at NPR 18 foreign bureaus. These are staffed by full-time correspondents abroad. Many of them are bilingual. Many of them are multilingual. Recently, and this is an example of the issues we face in what our expectations are and what the service is to us from our media, non-commercial or commercial. Recently, the Washington Post Company, which faces the same, unfortunately, the same declining readership as many other major dailies in this country and small dailies as well, has had to make cuts in its foreign reporting. And they reduced their foreign staff by two bureaus. National Public Radio, a nonprofit, non-commercial, non-network, with its 18 foreign bureaus, now has more foreign bureaus than the Washington Post. One of the great iconic presenters of news in this country. One of the most authoritative and respected newspapers in this country. What is that about? It certainly is not about the drive for profit that has marred the face of a lot of print journalism in the country in the past 15 years. It's about other issues which they have to deal with. But the real story is, how did NPR, a nonprofit, supported consensually by millions of Americans every year who contribute money voluntarily to their own stations? So as Robert Siegel has said, if you could get the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal free on your doorstep, why would you pay for it? But typically in this country, more than 2 million people a year cross over the boundary of non-support and make a commitment because they understand that public radio is something they really should support as citizens looking for the kind of information which can help them connect to their society in new ways. Why are we there with 18 bureaus? Why did we reopen a permanent bureau in Kabul? Pardon me. Why do we have 3 bureaus in Africa, in West Africa, East Africa, and South Africa? And we opened a bureau in Shanghai 2 years ago in addition to our bureau in Beijing, which has been there for nearly 20 years. What is that about? Because we know, we've been told by listeners and by our stations, that their listeners And NPR has no listeners. We don't have any transmitters, no frequencies, no call signs, and no audience. The audiences are the audiences of the American communities. We've been told by our station managers, by their program directors, and by individuals, the one thing America, that these listeners want in a form that can be most useful to them is contextual narrative journalism from abroad, foreign news. You can talk to many print editors in this country, daily newspapers, and they'll tell you there's no market for foreign news in their newspapers, and so that so-called news hole, the amount of space devoted to foreign news, has declined. It may happen across the country generically, but in public radio, our foreign news has been growing because people really want to know, and especially after 9/11, what is it that's going on out there that we simply don't understand? The Pew Center on Americans, and in fact, how the Americans in media did a survey after 9/11, which found that interest in foreign news had doubled from like 7% to 14%. And they further asked questions about why is it that foreign news seems so distant from you and distant from your interests. And the typical answer that came back is because I don't understand it. It's not told to me and not presented to me and reported to me in a way I can actually make contextual understanding of it relative to what else I know about the world. At NPR and in other places in this country, the search for contextual foreign news to tell a story that nourishes our habits of mind, whether it be from Beijing or Johannesburg or Moscow or Cairo or Istanbul or Baghdad, is a huge piece of what we have committed to do. And the response has been very powerful. We think we're doing the right thing because we know that listeners regard it and respect it. And I will tell you, when I look at the kinds of people who serve us in Baghdad and in Kabul and other places on public radio salaries, I know they're not there for the money. They don't have to be there. It's entirely voluntary. If any of you have heard the reports from Anne Garrels from Baghdad, which preceded the war there, for example, you know the kind of dedication that that person brings to it. And it's not because of the money we pay her. This is a public radio operation. We pay nonprofit salaries. But she can do journalism for us, and so can her colleagues. That is remarkable, memorable, sticks in the mind in a very special way. And that has to do a little bit with how radio actually works. And after 25 years at the Washington Post, still recovering from print, I can say to you that part of the secret of radio is the fact that you can't see it. What does that mean? It means it only plays up here in our imaginations. In my estimation, it's the only true mass medium of the imagination. And therefore, it can have, if it's done right, if it invites people in as explorers in the realm of what our values are in a civil society and what do we need to have there to help us understand ourselves better, if we invite people in for that kind of a dialogue, then it isn't something that becomes forgettable. It often becomes something you can never, ever forget. I was driving on an interstate a few years ago with Scott Simon, the host of Saturday Morning Edition, was interviewing a young woman about a memoir she had written about the Cambodian genocide. And pardon me. And he asked her a question that was approximately, "And then what happened to your father?" I was driving at 80 miles an hour on this interstate. It was a March morning. There was a lot of spray and sort of freezing rain coming down. I shouldn't have been doing 80. I probably should have been doing 50. I wasn't paying attention to what I was doing. I found myself gripping the steering wheel like this, trapped and caught in the silence between the question and the answer. What was that about? And I asked later the producer of the show, what happened there? And the producer said, well, the interview was actually recorded the day before. And I said, what happened then? But about it, it was a 45-minute interview. We had about 8 or 9 minutes of this interview on the air. Why that? And he said, it was such a powerful silence, I would never touch it. What was that about? It was about thinking about how to project past the microphone to the listener and to see if we couldn't be invited into this space of regard, of silence, of reflection before the answer came. I think that kind of respect for who you are and what it is we're trying to do is exactly what you ought to expect from all of us in broadcast. Every one of us, whether we're commercial or non-commercial, and you ought to be able to expect it from journalists no matter where they are. Now, there are going to be, of course, the need for headlines very quickly. In the digital age, we see headline news as essentially a commodity. You can get it almost anywhere. If you go to the New York Times webpage and look at its headlines, which are being refreshed all the time, about half of them come from the Associated Press. They're not from New York Times people. It's not because they've relinquished it or because they can't do it. It's quicker. It's more effective. AP is there. So let's use it. At NPR, we would never be able to compete with the New York Times or its website or the Washington Post or CNN or any of them. We don't have the staff and the resources. With our staff of about 400 reporters, editors, and producers, we're barely the size of a large mid-sized newspaper, about the size of the Baltimore Sun, for example, which has a circulation of several hundred thousand. With our circulation, which is weekly 26 million listeners in this country, double what it was from 8 years ago, we have a responsibility to use that the best possible way we can to connect. And that, I think, is something you should expect to be treated with respect by those who purvey news to you and information. Otherwise, it's just a commodity, and we're just users of commodities. And that's not what a democracy is about. Let me talk about something else that allies to this. We believe, I firmly believe, that this is not a nation of red states and blue states. Remember that old cavil of a few years ago? You could see it on any screen in this country, reds and blues. And the fight was over the reds and blues. Even the states that voted heavily one way or another are never only that, as we all know. This nation is far more diverse, far more subtle, far more demanding, far more difficult to understand, and far more flexible and moving all the time than being confined to a polarized notion of who we are, red and blue. It's a fake. And you should demand that that is not the presentation you're going to put up with from your news media. And if you see it or hear it that way, I think you've got to take exception to it. They need to hear from you in the same way that public radio hears from you every day of the week. I think it's very important that we be active citizens and that editors and producers and news figures hear from you if it isn't up to snuff for what you need as a member of a free, self-governing society that has to go to the polls, whatever the polls are, whether it's a school board bond issue or a sewer district bond issue or a city council or whatever it might be that demands us as citizens to participate and expects us to do so if we're to nourish who it is we are and who our community is. So the sense of involvement and engagement goes beyond where it was. And I think we can reestablish lines of respect and thresholds of what we can take and what we can't take, and people need to hear that from us. At NPR, I created an ombudsman a few years ago. I'd seen that at the Washington Post that Ben Bradley had done it. And the ombudsman is meant to be the listener's representative and explain some of the peculiarities of news gathering, which are really very peculiar sometimes and hidden from view, because what you hear is not all the time as it happens. A whole lot of things have happened before it gets to air. Scripts are written, interviews are made, questions are re-asked, questions or interviews are redone, and so forth and so on. So the complexities of this thing are not simply what's on the air, obviously. The ombudsman now gets close to 100,000 emails a year and untold numbers of letters and phone calls about our reporting and questions about how we do it and why we didn't do it better. And part of the answer is journalism, like every other human endeavor, is an imperfect calling. It doesn't get all the facts all the time. It doesn't get, sometimes it gets none of the facts all the time, and sometimes it gets all the facts none of the time. It's all those variations. The real issue is, will they go back and do it again? Will they try again? Will they keep on the story and try to understand better, even if they don't go back to the very same subject in the very same place, the very same next day? Will they continue to try to understand and present to us some context for what that event, what was behind that event, what caused it, and what the effects are? And that demand, which is made of public radio, I think we should make of our other media as well. We all stand before you only on the basis of what your expectations can be. I've been before groups where they say they take exception to some things we've done, and I say, but our standards in the newsroom are the same standards that are practiced, the same editorial guidelines and news management guidelines that you'll find at the Associated Press and at Reuters, the two most used English language news services in the world. They're the same guidelines, and we follow them in the same way as the New York Times, or pick any newspaper that you respect and regard. And the answer comes back, but you're public radio, we hold you to a different standard. What standard is that? A higher standard. Well, tell me what the higher standard is. If it's the standard that says we're telling only your side of the story or that side of the story, that's not our standard. Our standard is to try to skeptically bring lots of ideas, lots of conflicting ideas, frequently lots of disagreement in front of people. And as the reader said, but said to me, you should blame them. And I said to the reader, no, that's your job. And I think that's when we're doing our job right. So from a self-activating democracy, I want to, we're coming to a pausing point here. I want to finish off with a few other stories. One of them is that in the end, and this is one of the pieces that I find fascinating to me, if each of us looks at each other and then thinks about our own histories, we quickly discover, in the end, that no matter what we look like, no matter what we may think about each other, we think inside our own who we are, our own identities. We can make a real simple conclusion about who we are as Americans, that we're actually all immigrants. Even the first Americans, the first people who lived on this continent, came from another place. We didn't spring wholly formed out of the earth. This is not where humanity is known to have started. It started elsewhere, and it found its way here, either by force and in chains and in terror, or in freedom and in hope. The real point of all that is that as immigrants, we owe something beyond where we are. We have a collective sensibility about what it is we are in this country, what we're trying to do, and we also have different ideas about that. But ultimately, there's something in the recesses of our minds which tells us we did come from some other place. And I think that's always been important to us as individuals in this society, to recognize that indeed, even in the 21st century, when the long arc of American emergence as a world power and then a superpower and then the only surviving, by the terms of the time, the only surviving superpower, as that long arc continued to rise, we have to look at ourselves again today and ask ourselves, what do we owe those beyond our borders from where we came? And symbolically, what do we owe to others beyond our borders because we all came from some other place? We need to understand those realities where those people live, because that's part of who we are today. Our destiny is not to be separated. but to be joined in some new way, in some way that respects and regards and encompasses the complexities that are out beyond where we are. And so that asks us, of us, an opening of our thinking and a determination to find beyond where I am today what is happening out there that I don't today understand, what is happening out there that tomorrow I'm not sure I even want to know about. But what it is out there, those events far from here, that tie me somehow in some ineluctable way to those people and their fates, and therefore ultimately to our fate in this country. And now we stand at a time when these issues are sharply put before us, as at any time, and in a very confusing and complicated way. We cannot turn away from that. We must engage. And one of the ways we can engage is to demand of our journalists and their organizations, which put them in the field and nurture them, whether it be here in Nashville or beyond the borders of Nashville, beyond the borders of the reach of our transmitters, of the four transmitters that are part of the station here, that demand us to demand that there be more responsible investigation, by which I mean exploration, that there be more responsible explication, by which I mean clear reporting, and finally, there be a commitment by those who presume to serve you with their journalism, that they do it with respect and regard for you all, and for all of us together, not simply as one kind of human being, but as complicated people who demand answers, because we can't be both ignorant and free. Thank you very much.